Good morning, good afternoon. Please go ahead. This call is now being recorded.
Thank you, Francesca. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the PPSAI Working Group call on the 28th of April, 2015. On the call today, we have Tatiana Krumstova, Holly Raich, Steve Metellus, Graham Benton, James Gannon, Destiny Perrin, Sarah Wild, Frank Michalik, Vicki Scheckler, Michaela Nyland, Griffin Barnett, Paul McGrady, Roger Carney, Phil Corbin, Alex Deacon, Todd Williams, Karen Mel Chernobyl, Jim Bykoff, Kathy Kleiman, Susan Calabucci, and Terry Stummy. I have apologies from Darcy Southwell, Osvaldo Nueva, Don Blumenthal, and from staff we have Mary Wong and myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all participants to please, and Marika Konings, I apologize. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. And Val Sherman just joined us as well. I'll now turn it back over to you, Steve.
Okay, thank you. This is Steve Metellus. We have a lot to cover today. So first, let me just ask if anybody has any updates to their statements of interest to share. If not, let's get started. I think the draft of the initial report went out in a timely way on Thursday. I think Mary has put together a summary of the comments received as of yesterday evening Eastern Time, and then one more comment came in after that. So what I would suggest is that we just walk through these. I think we can move through a lot of this very quickly, since most of these are non-controversial and good improvements. And then let's reserve a few minutes at the end for discussion of views on the deadline, the comment deadline for the draft report. So why don't we just dive in? You see on the screen in front of you Mary's consolidated list of the comments that came in. I think we can let me just start on the first one, which of what the square brackets mean in the executive summary. I think I'll just add to this that Kathy suggested in her note late yesterday evening that this go into the text rather than the footnote, and I assume there's no objection to that. So let me just ask if there's any objection to this reformulation of the meaning of square brackets and putting it into the text. Okay, if not, I'd like to take the next six bullets together. These are really good editorial suggestions about getting rid of reveal and since we're not using that term, standardize how we refer to some of these, deciding how we spell requester, moving the definitions and adding a couple of definitions. I guess I would just ask first if staff has any comment on these, because my suggestion on these next six bullets, getting down to through the first three under section 1.3.1, would be to agree to these and leave it to the staff to implement these in the draft report. Is there any objection to or comment on that?
Steve, this is Mary. We have no objections. We can certainly do it. The only request I would make to the group is that the two suggestions by Holly relating to requester and relay requires us to add a definition. I assume that's no problem, but I did want to draw attention of the group to that because it means we'll be suggesting language for those terms.
Well, yes, she suggested language here. So, unless anybody has any objection to that, I would assume that, again, I'm going to leave it up to the staff to implement this, but I think this is all pretty close to what we're looking for. Holly, you have your hand up, so please go ahead.
Thanks, Steve. Yes, I am, in fact, suggesting the definitions because, in fact, I think it will read far better if it's really clear exactly what we're talking about, and in particularly the reveal, I just would not use the term except to say if you want, disclosure means you reveal to the customer. What you reveal to the requester customer details. But otherwise, I just wouldn't use the term because it is absolutely confusing. So otherwise, Steve, I'm absolutely happy with just having the definitions, having them up front, and then used consistently throughout. And then I'd be very happy, and there's no need for discussion.
Okay. Thank you. And again, I'm going to leave this to the staff to, if there's any wrinkles that need to be ironed out, but I think we're all in general agreement on this. Okay, moving on to the fourth bullet, which deals with recommendation four, and I don't know if we can throw recommendation four on the screen, or I can just read it here. I think this is really about the second sentence of recommendation four, which says, in the cases where for privacy PP providers affiliated with a registrar, as defined by the 2013 RAA, validation and verification of the PP customer data was carried out by the registrar, re-verification by the PP service of the same identical information should not be required. And Darcy's asking, can the PP provider rely on its affiliated registrar's validation verification? I think the answer to that question is yes.
Yes.
Does anybody think it's different? So that's, Darcy, I hope that clarifies that point for you. Moving on to the next bullet. I'm sorry, Mary. I think we're back on the list here.
Mary, what happened to the list?
No, it's coming back.
Okay.
The next one on the list would be the fifth bullet. Should we require providers' terms of service to utilize the same definitions of publish and disclose as defined in the accreditation program? In other words, as in this document. So let me, and the staff has responded, yes, does this need to be made clearer? Let me just ask, I would certainly ask providers if they have any views on this. You know, ordinarily we're not, ICANN is not in the business of micromanaging the terms of service, but obviously for accreditation purposes it would be appropriate if that's the consensus of the group that they use that term, those terms publish and disclose. And I think that would certainly, it strikes me that that would increase the customer understanding of what these rules are. So I'll just ask if there are any comments on this fifth bullet question here. And I see McKaylee has his hand up, so go ahead, McKaylee.
Thanks, Steve. I'm McKaylee for record. One concern I would have here is, I mean, the policy is going to be written in American English. A German provider is probably going to provide their terms of service in German, a French provider in French, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Privacy proxy providers' terms of service to use the same definitions would be problematic because that won't work particularly well in translation. Thanks.
It's a good point. I mean, and one option here would be to say that this would be a recommended best practice to utilize the same definitions as much as possible. I see Holly is agreeing, I think, with McKaylee on this. Mary, go ahead.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks, McKaylee. It agrees with good points, especially as I'm not American. I was just wondering then if we put something in to say, you know, essentially convey the equivalent meaning in whatever language the terms of service is, because we do note, Steve, your point earlier that this is part of the accreditation framework, and this is a fairly significant recommendation from the working group.
Okay. Thank you. McKaylee, go ahead.
Thanks. Now, just on... I think I know where we're kind of going with this, and I don't have a problem with the general direction. It might be helpful in the policy that it's within the policy to have, you know, a section of definitions, and there are already a number of areas within ICANN policies where people are being directed to, like, the definitive source. So, for example, with who is output now, the EPP statuses, you're sent to the specific page on the ICANN or IANA website where you have the specific, where you have the actual definition. I mean, I don't want to get into the weeds on, you know, the what Mary's talking about, you know, equivalent language, blah, 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 because then we're opening ourselves up to some up to a silly argument about whether Luke's version in French is equivalent to the original version in American English or something equally silly. But I think this is something that, I mean, the kind of best practices concept is one idea, but, I mean, if we clearly have defined what the ICANN policies are on this with the actual definitions, then it shouldn't be too much of a problem. I mean, bear in mind that the ICANN contracts, policies, and everything else are written in language which is the at the opposite end of the spectrum to plain English. So for a lot of us, we'd probably be hoping to write it in a language that normal people can understand. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Michele. Any other
Hello?
Any other comments on this? Yes, go ahead. Did someone want to be, get in the queue? Did someone want to get in the queue here, or was that a hello for some other purposes? Okay, well, I think I take it from this discussion, although brief, that we don't have a consensus to actually require exactly the same definitions of publish and disclose. But I think Michele's point is well taken. If those are clearly defined, and if the terms of service have to meet certain elements, which is what Recommendation 7 really is talking about, then you know, if they, it would be on a case-by-case basis if they don't explain what disclosure or publication is. And obviously, it seems like it would be a best practice to hew as closely as possible to those definitions or their equivalent in whatever the language is of the terms of service. So my recommendation is that we just pass over this. One idea is to ask the staff to put in a sentence in the, I don't think it necessarily needs to be in the executive summary, but in the discussion of this in Section 7, to mention that it would be a best practice to adhere as closely as possible to the terms disclose and publish or their equivalents in the language of the terms of service. Is there any objection to including that, a sentence like that in there? Okay, if not, let's move on to the next couple of bullets that deal with Recommendation 7, the third bullet point. And I'll just read this as it stands right now. And this is, again, one of the things that needs to be in the provider's terms of service. Clarification as to whether or not a customer, one, will be notified when a provider receives a publication or disclosure request from a third party. And two, in the case of publication, whether the customer may opt to cancel its domain name registration prior to and in lieu of publication. So the first point, it really goes to Holly's concern. It's the first one listed here. And, why would a customer not be told? And I think the staff's response makes sense here. In some areas, it's certainly the case if the framework we have in here for intellectual property requests is adopted, then for those requests, the customer will always be told. But because of law enforcement concerns and others that aren't covered by that template, there may be circumstances in which it's left up to the provider to make that decision. So I think that's the explanation of that. Let me just ask... Holly seems to be accepting that. Michele, is this on this point?
Yes, it is. Thanks, Steve. It's Michele again. You can also be receipt of a court order which forbids you from disclosing the fact that you received the court order. But the U.S. government has this charming thing called, I think it's FISA. So there could be a number of very, very good reasons which you may not like, but which forbid you from doing it. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so, James, did you have something on this point?
Yeah, I possibly might suggest that we put in some language to say, unless prohibited by law or by court, that the customer will be informed. So it's similar to a warrant canary, that you have a section in the policy to say, no, unless the court order specifically bars you from informing the customer, then you will inform them.
Yeah, that's certainly something that could be in the policy or the terms of service that the provider adopts. But I don't think at this point in this in the process we can open it up to that as a requirement across the board. Again, we don't have, outside of the intellectual property sphere, we don't have a template for quite how this will operate. We're soliciting suggestions for more templates on that, but. Thank you for that comment. Moving on to the next point on Rec 7, third bullet point, and this goes to the second part of this bullet point, which says, in the case of publication, whether the customer may opt to cancel its domain registration prior to and in lieu of publication. Again, this is an option that the provider may or may not offer. But Holly makes the point, and actually was in my comments as well, that they should spell out whether they offer this option for publication and for disclosure. I'm not sure why it would necessarily be different, but let's cover both publication and disclosure here. So, in other words, the provider needs to say in its terms of service whether it will or won't give the customer that option to cancel the registration in lieu of disclosure or publication. So is there any objection to that way of resolving it, which is consistent with Holly's comment here?
Mark Kennedy doesn't like it.
Okay. Michaela doesn't like the idea of being, well, we already have in there, we've had in there for a long time that you have to inform when it's about publication. So this is just when it's about disclosure. And again, you can say this is not your policy. So that's really up to the other one. Okay. Thank you, Michaeli. Thanks for that clarification in the chat about the previous point. Okay, so that unless there's anything else on Recommendation 7, the third bullet point, I had a drafting change there, which is simply because we say whether a customer, we say whether the customer twice. So let's move on to Recommendation 8, the first bullet point.
Sorry, Steve. Michaeli, I'm running kind of 10 seconds behind you. It's not intentional, okay. I swear. Just on this point about cancellation of registration, are we saying that people will always have the right to cancel the registration, or what are we saying?
No, we are not saying that. We are saying that if the provider offers that option, they should disclose it in the...
Okay, so it's an if. That's fine. That's fine. That's perfect. That's all I need to know. Thank you.
Okay. Recommendation 8, the first bullet point. I think this is pretty straightforward. I'll just read the first bullet point here. Privacy proxy services should facilitate and not obstruct the transfer, renewal, or restoration of a domain name by their customers, including without limitation a renewal during a redemption grace period under the ERRP and transfers to another privacy proxy service. And the point that I think Darcy raised was whether that should be transfers to another registrar. I think the answer to that is yes. But I would certainly stand to be corrected if I'm wrong on that. So in other words, they would not obstruct the service, the privacy proxy service would not obstruct a transfer of a domain name to another registrar. Is there any objection to that point? Network connectivity was lost. Are we still on the phone?
Yep.
I think so.
Okay. So
Steve, this is Kathy. Can I ask a question, though?
Well, hold on just a second. Are those, I think our Adobe room is down, everything, the screen grayed out here. for me. It's
on your end, Steve. Try refreshing your browser.
Okay, I will try that. Yeah. Go ahead, Kathy. With your question.
So, I have a question. Whenever we use acronyms, especially those that reference back to the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, can we explain what they are? We're going to have a lot of people reading this report who may never have read or heard of the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, and I think we have to make it as easy for everyone to reference all the terms as possible.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. That's kind of the ICANN standard now is to put in the references. I'll leave it up to the staff to determine whether those references, those acronyms should be spelled out each time or just at the first time or the first time it's used in each section. But I think that's a good point, and I'll ask the
staff. And what was the one here, because I don't have the text in front of me, EERP? The one you just read.
RRP?
Yep.
ERRP.
Yeah, I don't remember what that stands for, but it's about the redemption grace period.
Right, sure. This one in particular, I think we should spell out. Thanks.
Sure, the registrars could
expired registration recovery period.
Thank you.
Okay. Steve, if you're not back yet in Adobe, James Gannon has his hand up.
Okay, well, go ahead, James.
James Gannon. I have a question. Why can't we include both Privacy Proxy Service Provider and or another registrar? Surely we should be leaving people open to doing either or both.
Okay, I'd be interested in any reactions to that suggestion. Well, this point starts with Privacy Proxy Services should facilitate and not obstruct the transfer, renewal, or restoration of a domain name. That ordinarily doesn't include, moving to another Privacy Proxy Service, but do people have any objection to that?
I see Michele's got his hand up.
Michele, go ahead. Thank you very much. I now seem to be back in the room, so hopefully I can be a little more confident on this. Go ahead, Michele.
Thanks, Steve. It's Michele again. I mean, to Arish James's point, I think part of the problem some of us might have with this is that in many cases the proxy privacy service is something which is run by the registrar or an affiliated company of the registrar. And we wouldn't want a situation where those details in who is are used via a third party that we don't control. I mean, so for example, as far as I'm concerned, they wouldn't actually be recognized as a proxy privacy provider under the terms of the contract anyway, unless they were associated with the registrar. Maybe I've missed something somewhere. But anyway, I think I've understood that correctly, though.
This is Irish James again. That's an understandable interpretation. So in that case, I'd support the second language of transfers to another registrar.
Okay. Thank you. Other comments on that? Okay. The next point here is from Recommendation 16, the first bullet point. And this is, I think, Holly's recommendation. This bullet point reads, all third-party electronic requests alleging abuse by a PP customer will be promptly forwarded to the customer, and then it goes on from there. And Holly is raising the point of whether we should say abuse or misuse. I think we could do that. I think we've been fairly consistent throughout in talking about abuse, or we've talking about abuse or malicious conduct back in Recommendation 12. So I'm not sure we've used the term misuse. So that would be my concern about throwing a new term in there, because abuse, while not totally defined, at least we give some indications of what it covers. So let me just ask for any further comments on that or any response from Holly.
Yeah, Holly Race for the transcript record. Thanks, Steve. It was just, it sounded abuse for somebody who is not as familiar with the term as the rest of us are and haven't lived with it for that long. It sounded a little bit harsh, which was the reason I thought, could we, you know, is it really all the time that bad? And it was an impression as to how somebody would read that who hasn't lived and breathed the words. But, you know, I'm pretty relaxed as to whether you want to use my phrase or not.
Okay. I guess I'd be interested if there are any comments from any providers on this, because this sentence is directed to providers. All third-party electronic requests alleging abuse by a PP customer will be promptly forwarded to the customer. This is in the relay section. Mary, you have your hand up.
Yes, I do, Steve. Thank you. And the first point was to echo what you said, that there is a consistent use of words like abuse in the report. Secondly, and it's a related point, the charter question actually uses the term illegal activities. And on the word abuse and illegal activities, I think in a different recommendation, we do make reference to things like the public interest commitments and the GAC safeguards as a starting point to develop a list of what those activities are. I don't know if this helps Holly's point as to whether we should just retain abuse or whether we might want to change it to something like illegal activities, but that's the backdrop and that's the word in the charter question.
Okay, I think you're referring to Recommendation 12 where it says alleged malicious conduct. Mm. That's where the references are to the PIC specifications and so on. So if we are going to add something here, I think it would make sense to add malicious conduct, but there seems to be a general sentiment, based on the chat anyway, that abuse might be okay in this, it might be the right word to use in this setting. Michele?
Thanks, Steve. Michele. I'm more comfortable with the term abuse. Misuse, to me, sounds like, I don't know, somebody used the wrong screwdriver when they were putting in a screw or something. I don't know. I mean, I'm not being facetious. I'm actually being semi-serious. It's just misuse to me. I mean, that sounds like then I'm going to be opened up to having to deal with, I don't know, people who build websites that only work in Internet Explorer, which I could see as being a misuse of the Internet, but definitely not a case of abuse. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So I think the consensus is we're okay with just leaving it as abuse at this point, unless there's objection to that. The next two are pretty straightforward. In Recommendation 16, we currently say in the second bullet point that a failure to that persistent delivery failure doesn't trigger any further provider obligations unless the provider also becomes aware of the persistent delivery failure. And then it says a persistent delivery failure will trigger the provider's obligation. So we need to say that when the provider becomes aware of it triggers provider's obligation to perform a verification, re-verification. So, in other words, it's just adding in that, removing the contradiction between those two bullet points so that a persistent delivery failure that the provider is not aware of has no consequences as far as further obligations. But if they become aware, then it may have consequences. And then 17, we do include a definition of law enforcement agency, but it does not state that it's taken from the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, and that probably should be done so people know where we got that from. And if they don't like that, they can, you know, address their criticisms accordingly. Any objection to those two bullet points, on the remaining one on 16 and then the one on 17? Okay, turning to the last two, which deal with Recommendation 20 about de-accreditation and how much agreement we have on the process.
Yeah.
I think we've gone as far as we can get at this stage on what we say about de-accreditation, with the recognition that obviously there's going to be a lot of implementation issues about how de-accreditation actually works. But let me just see if Holly, if there's anything you wanted to say on that. Let me just reference the staff, if the staff has any points that they want to make on this comment on recommendation 20.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. It's Holly for the record. I guess I was reading this thing thinking we really haven't spelled any of this out, so we should make it clear in somewhere in the interim report that as far as we've decided, there will be some kind of accreditation process. There will have to be, if it's an accreditation process, clearly somebody has to measure compliance. There has to be some kind of sanction if there is non-compliance, and none of that really has been worked out, and there's really only passing reference in the report to the fact that compliance, the ICANN compliance, will play a role. Not sure what that will be, so maybe we should at least flag we haven't gotten to that stage yet, and we would welcome comments or something, but it's just, it seemed to me there was a big gap in the report on this issue, just because we haven't got to it. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody else have their hand up? Because I've been kicked out of the room again. I'm trying to get back in.
no hand, Steve.
Okay, the suggestion is that we have something in there that says we have not addressed specifically the role of ICANN compliance. I mean, some of that is an implementation issue. I don't, you know, some of it might be something we would get back to in the next phase here. And one option, I'll ask the staff for their views on this, but one option is that we could have a sentence in the Section 7 discussion about this recommendation that basically says that. Does that sound like a reasonable way to proceed?
I would like to flag that because I'm sure there will be implementation, but
yeah.
I would like some discussion at a kind of a high level from input from everybody as to, you know, what do you think should be involved in terms of a process, in terms of what do you think should be a breach, and how are you going to measure it, and what, if any, is a sanction? I mean, keep it very high level, but some guidance so that when we come to an implementation phase, there is really some policy guidance as to what the hell it looks like.
I will point out we do have some guidance of that type in the recommendations now, because we say a graduated response approach to deaccreditation.
Yeah, I read
so
that.
That's some guidance, and I mean,
yeah.
I would group those together,
Steve, and say we've thought about at least a little bit, but can we flesh a little in, are there some high level responses to that?
Okay.
Because right now there's very little guidance for an implementation working group as to what a compliance framework would look like for this.
Okay. Let me ask Mary for any reaction to that as to the feasibility of including something in the draft report asking for public comment on the role of compliance. Mary?
Steve, this is Mary. There's no reason why we couldn't have a question soliciting public comment, but as you'll note from the staff comment in this summary document, this seems to be something that's more appropriately considered by the implementation review team, which would presumably comprise members of this working group and the community. So given that essentially the steps of first the accreditation and then the sort of compliance and the accreditation that follows really have to be designed in implementation, I guess I'm a little concerned at doing more than asking the question and putting anything more than that in the report. And I see that Michele has his hand up as well, Steve.
Yes, thank you. I'm back in the room at this point. Michele, go ahead.
Thanks, Michele, for the record. Yeah, obviously, I mean, from speaking just from my own perspective, unless there is some level of compliance enforcement, then this entire exercise is completely futile. And obviously, any compliance enforcement needs to be done in such a fashion that it's uniform and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. just so we're clear, and I, from my perspective, I don't see why the hell I should waste time, energy, and effort trying to make sure that our services are compliant with a contract if people aren't going to bother and get away with it. That would just seem completely ridiculous. I think part of what Holly was asking is around the de-accreditation process and everything else. I think maybe this is something that, you know, we need to put a pin in it and just say, look, you know, this is something that maybe compliance may need to weigh in on or something like that. I mean, we could get into the weeds on this now, trying to over-specify, but I mean, just the fact that we've noted there should be some kind of process there, I think, is sufficient. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Michaela. This is Steve again. There seems to be agreement that this would be an appropriate question to include in the draft final report, with the caveat that some of it may be an implementation issue and not a policy development issue, but that we're aware that compliance will play an important role in making sure that this, if this accreditation system is to be successful. So unless there are other comments on that, I would like to move on to the last bullet on Rec 20. Will ICANN need to approve finding a gaining provider? And this is because we have several references in our Recommendation 20 about de-accredited providers should have the opportunity to find a gaining provider to work with, and where feasible, the customer should be able to choose its new – well, that's about choosing a new one. But in terms of the gaining provider, my assumption is that ICANN would need to approve the gaining provider. Since some provider is being de-accredited, you don't necessarily want to leave it up to that provider to choose its successor. So I think that's understood, and maybe we should put in a reference to that in Recommendation 20. Is there any disagreement with that? Okay, thank you. Let's just move through the rest of these points here. On Section 1.3.2, we have a list of questions about law enforcement since we haven't really, since that's a topic that we haven't gone through. And one question is, what, if any, when there's a law enforcement request, what, if any, should be the remedies for unwarranted publication? And the question is raised here about whose remedies, would that include registrants? I think that's kind of embraced in the question, what, if any, should be the remedies for unwarranted publication? That would certainly invite people to raise the question of who should be able to invoke that remedy. But let me just ask if there's any comments on that. I see Holly's hand up. Go ahead, Holly.
Thanks, Steve. It's Holly for the record. I think part of that is, are there penalties for, and this is part of the compliance point. If there's unwanted publication, then in fact it means there's been a non-compliance issue, and I think we've already dealt with that issue. If there has been unwarranted publication, there's in all breaches of privacy, there's almost nothing you can do. The damage has happened, and that's the problem. So I'm not sure that there's a remedy that's possible other than some kind of action as part of a compliance framework would be my answer.
Thank you. S.C. McKaylee.
Thanks. McKaylee again. See, this is part of, if we start going down the route of unwarranted publication or unwarranted whatever, we're opening up a massive can of worms. Because one could argue, and I'm not going to, before anybody jumps down my throat, but one could argue that any publication without, you know, following particular things within a particular legal framework is unwarranted. I'm just wary of going down that route because, I just see it as causing us more headaches than anything else and not something I'd really want to get into. Thanks.
Thank you, Michele. Mary's pointed out in the chat that this question, the question about what, if any, should be the remedies, is in the charter. So I think it's fair to throw that out there to the public. But I think that embraces the point that, that Darcy raised here. So unless there's objection, can we move on to there's one comment here about Section 7. Stephanie, go ahead. Stephanie, we're not hearing you. So let's put your comment aside. Let us know when you're able to make it or enter it in the chat. Section 7. This is an editorial point about
editorial transition.
I'm sorry. What was that?
Hello?
Stephanie, go ahead.
Ah, you can hear me now.
Yep.
Preparing for the record, I'm responding to Michele's comment about the not wanting to go down the road of remedies for the customer in the event of what amounts to a privacy breach, as Holly pointed out. Damages is what you get in many jurisdictions. And it's a breach under privacy law, I would say, in many jurisdictions. So I'm just suggesting that we make some kind of comment to that effect, that we haven't dealt with it. There should be a remedy for the customer.
Okay, thank you. Well, we have in this section this question out there. So I'm going to cut off. Is somebody trying to speak? I can't understand.
That's Stephanie's line, I think. There we go.
Stephanie, are you back?
I think it's her line.
Okay, I'm going to cut off the discussion here. The questions are is out there, so we'll be getting the public's input on it. The point on Section 7, this is an editorial one about the transition sentence. I'm going to recommend that we leave that to the staff. And then on Annex E, these are mostly editorial as to whether we still need to retain the reference to a German notarized document, whether we should flag, and I would certainly agree with this. We have one area where we haven't specified a number of days for the provider after receiving feedback from the customer to get back to the requester. That certainly seems to be something we should call to people's attention. And then the last point here is about the bracketed language. And again, just to remind folks, we took off all the brackets in the annex, except where we're proposing alternative language. But everything in the annex and in the entire paper, of course, or the entire draft report is up for public comment. I'm seeing Stephanie here. Should we try this again? Stephanie, go ahead. No. Maybe that's an old hand because I see in this chat I have said what I had to say. Okay, Kathy, you have your hand up. Go ahead.
Hi, Steve. Yeah, some of this language has been around for a long time. I'm not sure I would remove it at this point. So the German notarized document, you know, I think we should keep it. That's been there for a long time. I don't think we lose anything by having it. And is Section 3B, is that a call for us to state a number of days now or to highlight that it's going out for public comment? I'd be in support of the latter, highlighting that it's going out for public comment. Okay. And I wasn't sure what the 3F question was. So.
3F was about the appeal issue, and it had been bracketed. But I think we all recognize that's open for public comment on the appeal question. And as I said, we're trying to reserve brackets for where we actually have alternative formulations of language, and we're asking people, as in the language that we talked about at the beginning of this call, you know, tell us which formulation you like best.
Right.
Okay. All right. Sense. So, and on the references of the German document, is Volker on the call? Volker is not on the call. He's on vacation.
He's in Japan.
Okay. I'm a bit hesitant to remove his German language that he put in there in the early days of this process. And without consulting him. I'm not sure that we'll be able to do that before we publish the draft report, but let's plan to retain that unless we can get his get some input from him on that. Okay, so I think this completes this document, and I think it's time to move to the next one, which was the comments that Kathy sent in last night. Mary, if you could put that up on the screen now. And Kathy, I see your hand is up. I don't know if that's an old hand or if you want to talk about what you put forward here. I'm glad to let you have a minute on the latter if you wish.
Terrific. I think that's an old hand, but a current topic, so thank you. Okay, I think we've covered 1 and 2 already, so page numbers and footnotes. So I appreciate Mary including that. So now we're on 1.3.3. So we're in the excerpt from the executive summary, which is, it sounds like what everyone's going to be reading and what may be the only thing translated. Although, Steve, if we might, in addition to timelines, if we could talk about translations at the end of this call, I think that would be really important. So what struck me as I read the executive summary now is that I didn't recognize a lot of it, and especially 1.3.3, which is specific topics on which there is currently no consensus within the working group. Of course, we drafted this executive summary quite a while ago, and it was before we really launched into some of the end of the relay work and some of the reveal work. And so this is the ideal opportunity to highlight what we need in the reveal and the issues that we have not reached consensus on, which is essentially all the bracketed language, some of which, including the stuff that went in last week, has enormous implications. And may override legal rights and protections. So I think what we should do in 1.3.3 is highlight what we have no consensus on and particularly focus on the reveal. And so I've tried to draft something that would do that. So one of the things, so if you look down to the paragraph in the middle that says to the opening of 1.3.3, after specific topics on which there's no consensus, let's add something like the working group has not yet reached final preliminary conclusions on key details of the reveal recommendations, see Annex 3, and show people where they are. We should really be highlighting where that is. There are many details still under discussion. And it looks like we're missing something over there. There are many details still under discussion and for which the working group has not yet reached consensus. These include what remedies should a customer be allowed, I think we were just talking about it, in the event a reveal request was falsely made. Second one, and this is one that really hasn't been highlighted, but there's still an open issue. Should requesters be allowed to escalate each and every rejection of a reveal request to a third-party forum, or should the working group be seeking reasonable standards and thresholds for such appeals to avoid unnecessary and potentially harassing and time-consuming appeals? What rights and protections should a customer be allowed and encouraged to set forward in his or her defense to provide a reasonable defense for maintaining its privacy? This is one of the issues that's all in brackets in Annex E in our drafts. How can customers be protected from requests from law enforcement from outside their countries when the issue of their domain name is for legal purposes in their own countries, but perhaps purposes deemed illegal in other countries? I thought we'd highlight here something that we've talked about, but it would be very interesting to hear references to get input from others, especially since we're leaving the whole law enforcement section open. Steve, you want me to stop there before we get to the whole issue of transactions?
Yeah. We have a few here, so let me ask Todd and then Mary.
Thanks. Todd Williams for the transcript. I sent an email on this to the group before the call, but I have not yet seen it pop up in my email, so I'm assuming that it hasn't popped up in everybody else's, and if it has, I apologize for the redundancy. But as I look through these four questions, I have two concerns. One, we have highlighted in brackets where there is language that is in dispute, and I'm not sure that these questions necessarily tie back in all cases to where there are alternative formulations that are on the table. To the extent that they do, I would say they're redundant because we've already highlighted that. My second concern is I would think that the objective of the initial report would be to present our recommendations / findings for public comment in as objective a way as possible, and these four questions I don't think do that. I think they're written in a way that begs the answer, and in that sense would be more appropriate perhaps for an additional written statement rather than what is going out from the group as a whole. But in any case, I think we have, in most cases where there is alternative formulations that have been debated among our group, I think we have highlighted that already. Thanks.
Thank you, Todd. Mary, and I think I see your hand up. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Steve, thanks, Kathy, for the suggestions. I guess just 2 points following up with Todd's that, first of all, I think these additions seem to do more with the working group's open questions on disclosure and publication, or you know, what was previously known as reveal, which is actually in 1.3.2, not 1.3.3. So maybe the suggestion that the staff has from there is that we need to make it clearer what 1.32 addresses, which is the remaining questions that we haven't yet gotten fully through on reveal, and what 1.33 addresses, which is one very specific topic on the commercial, non-commercial distinction that the working group clearly, after several weeks of discussion last year, had no agreement. So I think that's the first point, to maybe just make clear that 3.2 and 3.3 talk about different things, and that may be helpful in the additions that you're suggesting. But that secondly, in terms of the additions, some of this seems to have been discussed by the working group either as part of this initial discussion of the templates that were filled out for each of these related charter questions, or at least in part when the illustrative disclosure framework was proposed. So I think if we're going to put them at all, we would suggest them putting them in 1.3.2, but we would ask the working group to consider whether these are questions that have already been discussed, and if not, what the form is that we should put them in. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, thank you. Let me just say, from my perspective, I do think a lot of this reads much more like an additional statement, you know, proposing the questions that you would like to see the public address in their comments, rather than a presentation of what we've come up with so far. I'm certainly happy to have something in there that directs people's attention to Annex E and urges them to look at that and provide public comments on everything in Annex E. But I have to say I share Todd's concern that this does not belong in our we're not, obviously not going to achieve consensus in the next 6 minutes on these statements or these questions, most of which are closer to statements. And so I would just encourage you to include that if you want to put in an additional comment that would go out with the draft report. As you know, in our timetable, we provided for that. If any working group member wants to put in a brief statement of what they think are the critical questions, they can do so. So that's my view on this. James, I see, is that a new hand? That is a new hand. So James, go ahead, and then Kathy, your hand is still up, and obviously
it's a new hand, Steve.
Okay, so James, and then Kathy.
James Gannon here. I think I'd support the questions. I think they're all valid questions. I'm not sure what Kathy's drive to have them in any specific section. I'll leave that to her to, you know, describe, but I very much support them going out with public comment, as I believe that they are all questions that the working group can benefit from having strong answers to from the public comment period.
Okay, thank you. You could also include that in your additional comments. Kathy, go ahead.
Okay. Steve, I would like to highlight, and I think we should make sure that there is no agreement on unlimited appeals for requesters to third parties. That's been an issue that's been highlighted throughout. So if we could please highlight that that's not an agreement. If you want to move, or if Mary wants to move some of this to 1.3.2, that's fine. But I don't think we're highlighting Annex E enough. So let me go on to 1.3.3, because talk about things that are leading. I think 1.3.3 is a very leading section, because I don't think it really balances what's being talked about here. And I think it offers a solution from the co-chairs that is not a solution that's been embraced by the group. So I'd like to, if we're putting this out and this is what's going to be translated, I would strongly like to recommend the addition of language that says, and here what we're doing in 1.3.3 all is, it seems like the only issue we have no consensus on, and I don't know if I agree with that, is whether somehow we should be not allowing proxy privacy transactions for proxy privacy used for domains used for a commercial purpose involving some kind of financial transaction. And we really haven't put the details in that we talked about all these. It seems very leading. This whole section is very leading to almost one type of answer. So I'd strongly recommend adding, and if you page down to my second page of comments, there's a paragraph that says, in addition, and that's the existing text, and then it says, add, or I should say, please add. Other members of the working group noted that fundraising and membership drives are often performed by the very groups and organizations seeking proxy privacy registration for protection, including minority political groups, minority religious organizations, ethnic groups, and I'll let you read the rest of the list. These groups and their representatives note that in the laws of their countries, the mere collection of a donation or membership fee does not change their status from non-commercial to commercial. Further, many of these organizations conduct their financial transactions through third-party e-commerce companies such as PayPal, and thus are not processing the financial transactions directly. Accordingly, many in the working group submit there's no reason to breach the proxy privacy of registrations and groups for this reason. Just because they're involved in transactions, they shouldn't have proxy privacy. They note further that many in the working group submit that content regulation is beyond the scope of ICANN and properly the scope of national laws. This is something we discussed a million times, and I would like to strongly ask that it be added to 1.3.3 for a balanced review. If this is the section the whole world is reading, let them please read all sides.
Okay, we're just about out of time, but if people have a response to or want to comment on what Kathy just said, as far as adding this to 1.3.3, I guess this is, right? I think the questions are out there, and you've proposed an answer here, which I think I'm sure people will be hearing that viewpoint, and I'm
hey, Steve, it's Vic. I've got my hand up.
Who?
Vicki.
Vicki, go ahead.
Thanks. I strongly disagree with including that in the executive summary. I think the best place for a statement like that is in the additional comment that Steve had proposed earlier. There is, I would say, a minority group within this working group that agrees with Kathy's position, and so therefore I think it should be set up as a separate question and comment period and not within this section. And quite frankly, I don't remember discussing this issue before, but I know I haven't been on all the calls.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, we're about out of time here, and I just did want to make a final point here about the timelines. We've seen a lot of discussion on the list about whether the time should be extended, and the chairs are going to take that under advisement and try to figure out if what would be the impact of extending the normal 40-day comment period to 60 days, as several members of the working group requested. So we'll try to resolve that today if we can. And then on the issue of translations that has come up, I think it would be helpful, and I'll ask the staff if they can, since we know we have an executive summary document that's pretty much stable now, and so we know its length, maybe they can get a ballpark estimate of how long it would take to to get that translated into the the UN languages, because as I understand it, that is the procedure. And I think the working group guidelines make it clear that that doesn't delay posting of the English language version, but I think it is a fair question, how quickly can we get the translated executive summaries up to for everybody to look at. I will also say, since we're a little past the hour now, that again, people, under the timeline that we've set up, people will have until the end of their day, Thursday, to if they have an additional comment or that they want included in the to go out with the draft report. I would ask that people keep it concise, if possible, one or at most two pages. Again, that's your call, but I think that would be most helpful. Polly, I see you have your hand up, so let me let you have the last word on this call.
I'm just asking what the rush is. We've already got call for a longer comment period, which would mean we're not going to meet discussing the deadline for discussing in BA what the comments are. This draft still has a lot of work because there's a lot of, I would say, differing views, and I'm just wondering why we are rushing this so badly when, in fact, we really could give ourselves the time to come up with something that everybody's happy with. I'm just really conscious that people don't agree, and maybe we just need more time. Well, I mean, the why are we treating the deadline as gospel when, in fact, we've had a lot of people on the list today saying we ought to have a longer period of time, in which case we can give ourselves another week? Just really is a serious question. Thank you.
Well, thank you for raising the question. I don't agree with your characterization of what's been on the list. The list has been about the timeline for comments.
Yeah, exactly.
And whether it should be 40 days or 60 days. So sure. We're going to look at that and try to make a decision on that today. But we've had this deadline of trying to get the report out next Monday for several weeks now. And people have had time to review the document, and people came up with, including you, came up with a lot of very substantive comments, which I think we've gone through today and have made some improvements in the document. It's not going to be perfect, and frankly, as somebody that's been I think 66 of these meetings, I don't think the idea that if we only had another week or two, we would all agree on this. I think that's fanciful. So
okay.
I think that's my take on this. And welcome, Vicki. Is that a new hand or an old hand? Okay, I'm going to take that as an old hand. Mary, let me let you have the last word since we're already over time here.
Thank you, Steve. And just real quickly, I just wanted to emphasize that the deadline for the group is driven in large part because of the need to have this implemented by January 1st, 2017. As I think we've noted when discussing the work plan, the best-case scenario, if we do meet our original deadline of submitting the final report to the GNSO Council in September, is that the Council and then the Board adopts our recommendations without much question by, say, January. That leaves less than 12 months to design the entire accreditation framework, to notify all the providers and affected parties who may need to update and change their procedures. And I can just try to give a few months' notice of those things. So I think looking at it from an overall timeline into implementation, we really are running up against a very tight timeline. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, thank you. And I thank everybody for their contributions today. I think we accomplished a great deal. As I said, we will be getting back. The chairs will be discussing these timeline issues and getting back to you hopefully today on any changes there. So with that, I'll call this meeting to a close. And thanks, everybody, for your participation.
Thank you.
Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines. Francesca, if you can please stop the recording. Have a wonderful rest of your day.